Well, thank you for coming. We are in the framework book again. We are in chapter 19, continuing to go through the Old Testament, kind of an overview of the Old Testament, which is something we're going to try and do fairly quickly. That's all I've got tonight. I've got more at home. I'll bring some more. I wasn't expecting such a larger crowd. It's a summer night. I thought, well, everybody would be home, but I'll bring some more. Again, chapter 19, page 107. We're doing an overview of the Old Testament. And if you, well, let's go back to just kind of catch up here, back to page 100. And we'll kind of talk about what we talked about last week. And then we're going to hit and kind of review, I think, the life of David tonight, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. Part of it's in 1 Chronicles. But on chapter 19, page 100, we begin there with the Exodus, talking a little bit about the Egyptian history with Moses and the people that he was involved with as far as the pharaohs. Talk about the 10 plagues, got the Israelites out of Egypt with the 10 plagues, of course, as you know, and they got to Mount Sinai. God gives them the law to help establish the nation. Those first books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, is the calling of Israel, then establishing them as the nation of Israel. The law of Moses, you can see on page 101, is broken down into three basic parts, which helps kind of clear up some confusion. There's the moral duties, just some basic moral codes that would be true at any time in history. There's going to be the civil laws. These are the laws that God established for the nation of Israel and how they would run their civil government. We can learn from them, but we're not obligated to follow their civil laws. Of course, we can learn from them. The moral law is a little more serious. And then are the moral codes a little more serious. And the third thing was involved in the law of Moses was the religious rituals, the spiritual revelation that God brought to the people. All of it was symbolic, or the rituals pointed to something, a greater truth, but it was part of it was their Bible class, the tabernacle and all the things they went through. So that kind of preserved the revelation for the people. And when you look at the law of Moses that way, you can understand it. Of course, it was given to them in the book of Exodus. Leviticus kind of explained the religious code, the priesthood, and some details there on setting up of the tabernacle. Numbers records the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, that time between the spies not wanting to take the land and the time that Joshua was actually ready to lead them in. And then Deuteronomy is basically Moses talking to the second generation. It's kind of like a review of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, kind of saying this is where we came from, this is where you're going, and kind of taught that second generation. The good news about that for us as a culture is that first generation was, of course, a faithless generation, didn't want to follow God. The second generation, just 40 years later, was ready to take the promised land. They had seen enough, they had heard enough, they were equipped. So we've talked about this before. The Hope for America's Last Generation book talks about the four-generation decline of the fall of a society. It takes, in that sense, four generations before God will judge a nation and remove it from history. But the good news there was you can turn the thing around in one generation. That second generation was the generation that conquered the promised land. And so that's good news for us. On page 102 of the book framework, you can see the picture of the tabernacle. And, of course, we could spend weeks talking about the tabernacle and what's involved in there. Page 103 shows the maps of the entrance campaign of Joshua taking Jericho, the central area of the land of Canaan, the southern campaign. And then they marched north up to Hazor. There's a picture of the base of the wall of Jericho there, or the terrace actually holding up the earth, and on top of that would have been the mud brick or the clay wall that actually collapsed. Those are some pictures that we took when we were in Israel. Same thing there on the second page, 104. Some maps of pictures of Hazor. You got the layout. Then when Joshua takes the land, of course, in the book of Joshua, he takes the promised land. And the first part of the book is about the entrance campaign, the central campaign, the southern campaign, the wars that they fought, the kings that they killed. But then the second half is at the bottom of page 104, where they set up the land. The tribes were each given a portion of the land. And you can see a little bit about that. And, of course, that plays big throughout the rest of the Old Testament of where the different tribes were at. We did tell a story last week about the tribe of Dan, who thought it was too difficult to live there by the Philistines, and they packed up and went north of the Sea of Galilee, up kind of in the area of Naphtali. And that, they thought that was an easy place to live, but it ends up that's where all the invasions throughout history end up coming from, including the end times invasions. That's where the Arameans came through, and the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. They always come right north of the Sea of Galilee, cut through the mountains there, and go through Megiddo into the land of Israel. So they were always the first ones defeated. So they would have been better to stay by the Philistines. Then comes the book of Judges. And on page 105, you can see a chart or a diagram of the book of Judges and the cycle they went through. They continued to go through these cycles of being free in their freedom, of drifting from God, embracing false gods, which we identified as false philosophies. We have no false gods in the sense in our society, per se, but we do have a lot of false philosophies that come from the false gods. And when they embraced false philosophies, they lost touch with reality, lost touch with God's regulations, and they went into some kind of oppression, which led to being invaded by foreign oppression, which led them to being oppressed and crying out to God for a deliverer, and God was faithful and would bring them a deliverer throughout the different cycles they went through. Another thing to notice about the book of Judges is the judges don't necessarily go in chronological order. After this judge came this judge. After that judge, then came another judge. They are judges from different tribes. Many times the judges were simultaneous. For example, it's probably the case that while Samson was the judge over in the land near Dan in that area, it would be the days that Samuel was also on the rise, or the tabernacle was being set up also. So a lot of these judges would overlap. They're territorial judges or leaders for the people. Another thing about the book of Judges we mentioned on page 105 is the ridiculous stories that you hear in the book of Judges. And there's really no reason to try and make sense of them in this. When I was younger and I teach Bible, I try and say, well, what God was doing was this, and this is the way God worked with people. To understand the book of Judges, you have to understand, well, let's go to 1 Samuel, that's where we're going to start tonight. You have to understand this verse right here. Because again, Samuel, we're going to pick up tonight in the book of 1 Samuel. And in 1 Samuel, this is the end of the days of the judges. Samuel is, in a sense, one of the final judges. And he's going to hand it over to the first king of Israel. But to sum up the days of the judges and to understand why you've got so many crazy stories, like Gideon making himself an ephod to become a priest. Jephthah apparently sacrificing his daughter. Again, there's some people trying to explain that away. But human sacrifice was typical of Canaanite culture. Abraham had the situation with Isaac. So again, it's not radical, especially when you understand the people. Samson's lifestyle. Then we have the story of Micah and the Levite and all the things that take place there with the concubine who had been raped being chopped up into 12 pieces and sent to the different tribes of Israel. These are all wild stories. But you understand, you don't have to try to justify God in these stories when you understand this verse in 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 1. It says, the boy Samuel ministered before the Lord under Eli. And again, if you understand, we'll talk about Eli and his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They were very corrupt. In those days, the word of the Lord was rare. There were not many visions. In other words, the people had drifted so far from the word of God. When it says the word of the Lord was rare, that means their understanding of God, his purpose, his direction, if you want to say God's philosophy, was rare. They are so engulfed in the Canaanite philosophy, the false philosophies of their foreign gods, that they had no understanding of reality. And this led them to make ridiculous decisions and ridiculous priorities and values that lead to these stories here in the book of Judges. It's a warning to us as a culture, if nothing else, of when you drift away from God, drift away from his reality, his philosophy, or what we can sum up by saying drift away from the word of God, you're going to end up with a culture that cannot find their way through situations, and they're going to have ridiculous answers. And, of course, I think we're living in days like that. If we do not get some kind of revival in our culture coming back to the word of God and understanding of God's reality, God's natural law, the basic thing our culture was based on, if you go back to the writing of the Constitution, these men, the people that day, believed in some natural laws of God, that this is the way the universe worked, that were lined up with reality and gave us the culture that we've got today. When you drift from those and you forget those, or you ignore those, or you rewrite those laws of reality, including the Word of God, you're going to live in a universe, a world that doesn't really exist, and you're going to have all kinds of problems. That's the story of the book of Judges. On page 106, there's a picture of potentially where the tabernacle stood in Shiloh that we're going to be talking about today. So if you go to 1 Samuel chapter 1, an interesting verse, I think we pointed this out last week, 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 9, once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, that would be a festival, not a wild party, just a feast of Israel, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's, notice the word, temple. And again, the temple was not built until Solomon's day, so there is no temple. What are they talking about? Well, the tabernacle was a movable unit that they carried in the wilderness for 40 years. They carried it across the Jordan. They set it up then at Shiloh eventually, and this was the place it became during the days of the book of Judges and the early days of Samuel's book here. That is where the tabernacle would have stood, right there, probably at that location. There's still a wall that the foundations of it are still there, or at least potentially where it was, and that is why it was called a temple. It was some kind of a permanent structure, not a building, but a permanent, like I used an example of, I don't know if I used it here, but it's like if you had a motorhome and you traveled in your motorhome, but one day you pulled into some kind of a lot, plugged the thing in, took the wheels off, and lived in your motorhome. It's no longer a motorhome, it's now your house. But it's still the motorhome, it's just without wheels. That's kind of what the tabernacle was. It then became a tabernacle. After the book of Judges is the book of Ruth, which is a story of the genealogy leading up to the Messiah, including Boaz marrying Ruth, the Moabite. And when you go through there, the genealogy, you can see Selman. In that genealogy, it mentions Selman, who was the man who married Rahab, and she was the one that Joshua dealt with. Selman was one of the two spies. He comes down, and he is going to eventually have a descendant named Boaz, who's going to marry Ruth, who was a Moabite. And, of course, then we're going to get to David eventually, because after Boaz comes Obed, and then Jesse, and then David. So Ruth would be David's great-grandmother. David, of course, is going to have a Bathsheba, who is going to be the mother of Solomon, and she is a Hittite. So between the Israelites crossing the Jordan in the line of Solomon, you've got a Canaanite, a Moabite, and a Hittite all producing Solomon. So in fact, Solomon, was he Jewish? Well, of course he's Jewish, but he's half Hittite. And his great-great-grandmother was a Moabite. And so that kind of catches you up with some of those details of the genealogy of David and the line of the kings, which eventually produces the Messiah, and that is the book of Ruth. Very quickly, I want to just kind of breeze through the pages of this chapter to show you a few things, and then we're going to try and get to the Bible here and go through 1 and 2 Samuel. On page 107, new material tonight, just so you understand this. Here's a picture. This is one of the great things I saw in Israel when we were there. I saw many things, went all over the land of Israel. But here is a site. I was amazed to see these types of things because living in Iowa, in a secular culture with so much liberal Bible teaching, and we really don't even know if the Bible's true or not, that there's a story of David and Goliath in chapter 17 of 1 Samuel. And, you know, it could be true, maybe not. But the historical background, we don't really know. But when you get there and you see this right here, what you're looking at right here, of course, it's a small photograph. In the back of the book, there's a CD with all the photographs and JPEG, a lot bigger. But right here, this is where the story of David and Goliath would have taken place. Now, do I know for sure? Well, no, we don't know for sure. We don't, you know, the body of Goliath isn't just laying there or something. But the landscape that is described in chapter 17, the details as it begins chapter 17, it tells you the cities where it was at. It tells you the valley. It talks about the different landmarks. They are all right here, including back there. You can see in the background there it says the city of Succoth, S-O-C-O-H. That is the city. How do we know that was city on that hill right there? They've excavated it. They've pulled up pottery with the name of the city on it. So that is Succoth right there. Down in there, there's another picture I've got on my webpage, different places. Down there's a creek down in there, a dry water, a creek where the water would have flowed. We picked up rocks from it. You know, I picked up 5 smooth stones. But I heard another guy, when we got off the bus, you know, you go up there and pick up stones. Another guy says, do they mind if they pick up stones? He says, no. I said, they bring a truckload out every couple of weeks. So take all you want. So they're pleased to, you know, provide. Yeah. Just bring that little river rock out by Dave and Goliath location. And then the Valley of Elah right here. And the thing is, as you study the terrain, that Valley of Elah where I've got the arrow running, that valley runs right back into the land of the Philistines. That is the way back to the land of the Philistines. That you talk about along this road would have ran right through that area there. So again, unless the whole topography has changed, this is the location of David and Goliath. Not to prove anything, you know, not to say, well, that's some kind of a religious site you need to visit and worship God there. The idea there is for me, it becomes historical proof, archaeological proof that the Bible is based in fact. Of course, I'm not surprised anymore, but I used to be. At the bottom of the page there, you can see the city of David. And I think I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the city of Jerusalem. just because I find it interesting, and there's a couple things that I want to point out. So you can see right there, that is a drawing of the city of David, and realize this, the city of David was called Salem in the book of Genesis. It was occupied by a man named Melchizedek, who was the king and priest of Salem. When Joshua comes in the land, he never takes the city of Salem or Jerusalem, never takes it. But he does kill the king, because the king took his forces and joined the other Canaanites in battle against Joshua. And the king at that time was named Adonai Zedek. So you've got this guy right here, Melchizedek, in Genesis 2000 BC, in the days of Abraham. And then in the days of Joshua, we'll say 1400 BC, 600 years later, you've got a guy named Adonai Zedek. Both kings of the same city, of the Hittite, or the Canaanite city, the Jebusite city of Salem. Now, you can see the city right there. And as you look at that city, it had never been taken until David becomes king. And then David goes up and conquers the city. Coming in, if you look real quickly, on that little drawing there, you can see the Gihon Springs. And there's four towers right there. You can still see the base of two of those towers. And the remains, it's right there because the water source is right there. Man, I got a lot of things rushing in my head right now because I'm trying to cover about 700 years of history right here in my head. That Gihon Springs was the reason the city was built there, because that is the water source. That made that city a viable dwelling place. Without the Gihon Springs, you've just got a place out there in the wilderness somewhere. But because of the Gihon Springs, they could use water. And what the Jebusites had done, they'd built a wall and then they'd around the city, and I'll talk about the landscape there in a little bit, but they'd also dug a tunnel down, some stairways, and then a place where they could drop their buckets down into the Gihon Springs and bring water up. Nobody could take the city of Salem in Joshua's day. It was a well-fortified city, which gives you an indication that even in Joshua's day and the Judges' day, of course, there's still Canaanites living in there. In fact, David, after he takes the city, is going to purchase land just north of the city, just to the north, it's right in contact with it. He's going to expand it. He buys it, it's a threshing floor. He buys it from a Jebusite who was still farming the area. David took the city, but the Jebusites continue to live there and farm. Fine, we'll just live among the Israelites here. But then David buys it. That becomes the Temple Mount. Mount Moriah is included in that purchase. But anyway, there's that water source. Also about the Gihon Springs, in Hezekiah's day, we'll talk about this again later, he's going to, because of the invasion of the Assyrians and the influx of the people from the north coming down to live in Judah, the city's going to swell. They're going to need water on the other side of the city. So what Hezekiah is going to do is he's going to tunnel underneath the city of David, coming out kind of where it says Central Valley there, to bring water over to the other side of the city. Otherwise, you can imagine they'd have to come here every day. They'd have running water. They'd have to come every day to the Gihon Springs to get water for the day and maybe in the evening. Well, the people that are going to live on the other side of the city are going to have to walk a long ways through the city, down a hill, up a valley, down another hill to get water, and then carry it back. I mean, it'd be a full-time job almost getting daily water a couple times. So he's going to do that. Well, now, let's go to the back of the book, please. And it's on page 533. And I don't know if you'll find this interesting or if you can understand this. I'm sharing this from a perspective of having talked about Jerusalem and looked at pictures of Jerusalem, but really never being able to tie anything together until we went there and I stood there and I saw it and I learned a little bit about the history and how the walls have changed, and then I could come back. And again, what I've got here is not like unique to my book here or unique to my teaching. What is unique about this is I didn't really understand it, and I had all these maps and charts, never really tied it together until I got there and saw it. It's like, and then things came together. And I hope to be able to share with you now a little bit about the history of the city of Jerusalem, because again, we're not done with it. It's still going to play into the picture even today. Last week in Cairo, the city of Jerusalem is still the center of attention, and it's going to continue to be if the Bible's true. Well, anyway, what you have right here on page 533 is that a diagram or a map of that picture I just showed you. You've got the city of David. Notice right there you've got the Kidron Valley on the right. So here we go. Let me try this real quick. you're going to have a key. The Kidron Valley comes down this way. There is also a Central Valley and the Hinnom Valley coming across like this. These are steep. These drop off real fast. I walked down the Kidron Valley, and it's been filled in with rubble for the last couple, 2,000-4,000 years of being destroyed. It was shallower than it was naturally. But it was a steep walk down. I always thought between the city of Jerusalem and the Mount Olives over here was the valley. You know, when I think of a valley, I think of green grass. You kind of walked out here, and you just walked through the green valley up Mount Olives, which, of course, also has green grass on it. And that not the case. It's a steep drop-off. And that is why when David came to conquer the city of Jerusalem, they laughed at him. The Jebusite says, even the blind and lame could defend this city, David. What do you think you're doing? And they had a point. They'd gone through Joshua's invasion. They'd gone through the whole period of Judges. And now here comes this young king going to come take the city of Jerusalem. It's kind of like, it ain't going to happen, David. Because they had this embankment here. They had the rocky place down in the south here. And then the Central Valley came up here. The city was built on this fortress, if you would. And it's not like a mountain, but it's very steep. You'd have to crawl up out of the valley. And then once you got there, in fact, I think I can show you a picture here later. Then on top of this, they had built walls. So when you stand in the Kidron Valley and look up, and you think you're going to invade this with an army, it's impossible. Especially if they're up there ready to defend the city. The only place you could attack would be from the north, because then you could come in. But of course, they got walls, and this is where all their fortresses were at, the palaces were at this place, and their main line of defense was right there. So really, the Jebusites had to defend this area right here to protect their city, and no one's going to get through there. And they protect it for all those years. What takes place, as you remember the story, David tells his general Joab, if anyone's going to take the city, they're going to have to use the water shaft. Well, where's the water shaft? You see right here. The Gihon Springs, I've got it drawn on this map right here. And Joab went into the Gihon Springs. They climbed up, kind of like the Trojan horse story. They crawl up the water shaft, walk up the stairs into the city, unlock the doors, and David's army came in, and they attacked came up through the water shaft initially, and that's how they took the city. Now, so you can see this also. You've got the Central Valley here, so if you left, you'd come down, come down into a valley here. Then there'd be another hill right over here. This is called Mount Zion. Now, when you read your Bible and it talks about Mount Zion, Mount Zion's got a variety of meanings. First of all, this is the location called Mount Zion. This is Mount Olives. This is Jerusalem. This is a mount, and it's not a mountain. It's not smoke, snow peaked, and you got to climb up. It's a hill. I ran around here for several different days. I'd go out running. I'd run over Mount Zion, run down in the Hinnom Valley, come back. It's not a, it's like a hill. But also above there, Mount Zion. Mount Zion also, like in Psalms and other places, figuratively called, refers sometimes to heaven. It refers to where Jesus is ruling from. This whole area can be called Mount Zion because the mount is here. But just understand, when you read Mount Zion, there can be a location. It can be spiritualized, referring to heaven. It does say in Revelation that the Lord is, or the Lamb is meeting with 144,000 on Mount Zion. In that interpretation, you've got to decide, is that spiritual in heaven, or is that referring to the return of Jesus to the city, and he meets with the 144,000 that are marked in the actual city of Jerusalem. I tend to read that part literally after several years of study, but nonetheless, that's Mount Zion. Another thing you want to notice is Mount Moriah. That is the place where Abraham offered Isaac, Mount Moriah, which is that area bought by David from a Jebusite when he wanted to build the temple, or after the plague was stopped. So those are two mountains. So you've actually got, if you look at Mount Zion, the city of Jerusalem, and Mount Moriah, those are all hills with valleys in between them, except when you go to the north, that's going to be a straight shot. The Shepherd's Pool is a natural source of water also. That is going to become the Pool of Bethesda in the Gospels. When they have the porticoes, that becomes a Pool of Bethesda. And there was a tradition or a rumor, non-Jewish or non-Christian tradition there, that when that there's healing possible in that Shepherd's Pool. So that whenever the water was troubled, whoever got in the water first was healed. And that was more of a legend in the area. And Jesus comes down, remember, and the man says, why are you laying here? He said, well, I can't ever get to the pool to get healed on time. And Jesus will take up your mat and walk. That takes place right there. So that's been there from the days of the Canaanites. That pool was there. Of course, at this point, it's just a place where they'd water their sheep. It's just a pool of water. Eventually, they build it up. And that. Okay, so you got that. That's the city of David. Turn the page now. Page 534. Here you notice this is the days of Solomon. David has purchased the land to the north there, and Solomon builds the temple on Mount Moriah. Now, again, I don't want to get too bogged down here. Oh, my goodness. But Mount Moriah is just like this. Okay, this is just north of the city of David, okay? It's a mound. They're going to build a temple on this. And the problem with building a temple on this, it's just a little hill. So what Solomon is going to do, and then Herod is going to expand on it, is he's going to build, think of a sandbox. He's going to build a retaining wall around the mound, like this. You understand what I just did right here? It's imagine a sandbox. And then they're going to fill it in. So now the sandbox has now got a level surface, and this now becomes the Temple Mount. Did you just understand what I just did right there? I mean, that I didn't understand that for many years, because it's just a mound. But they build this right here. Herod himself is going to build the wall out even further right here to expand the Temple Mount, and this becomes what is known as the Western Wall. This is the only part that this is the closest part to the temple used to stand. That many of these walls are still there. But nonetheless, after this was all built, then they're going to put the temple up here facing east right here. This would be the temple's going to be built on that mound. Okay? So that's what's going to take place right there. If you want to see something here real quick, go to page 541, the last page of these maps. And you can see a topography, if you would, of the city of Jerusalem. And you're going to maybe take a moment to kind of get orientated to this. But you can see that little brick structure there above it's not on Mount Zion, but the other one next to the Kidron Valley. That's the sandbox I was talking about, built on Mount Moriah with the temple standing on it. Just in front of that would be the city of David that we were talking about that David just conquered. That would be the little part right there that David just conquered. That's the Jebusites. You can see the Kidron Valley. You can see how that is a very steep. It's steeper than I imagined. Of course, as I'm telling you this, you think, well, it's not as steep as Galen made it sound. It's fairly steep. You can see the Central Valley. Eventually, that Central Valley is going to be filled in to be level. And that's where people in Hezekiah's, they're going to move and make that part of the city. Today, you cannot see the Central Valley. It's covered up. The city covers it up right now. You can see the Hinnom Valley because it comes down on the west side and cuts over to the Kidron Valley, meets up with that, and then it continues down to the Jordan Basin of the Jordan River. But you can see Mount Zion, Herod's Palace is up there, and you also see the Mount of Olives and that area right there. Anyway, that's, I don't know if that helps you or not, that's the topography. Let's go back to page 534. And now on page 534, we can see the city of David with the Gihon Springs, but also now the additional land encompassed in the city of Jerusalem in Solomon's day for the temple. Again, it's a very large place. Shepherd's Pool still there. Mount Zion, of course, is still unbuilt on. Then you go over to page 535. This is now Hezekiah's day. This is about 200 years later as the city's grown, or, 150 years later. What is it? Yeah, 250 years later. Anyway, you can still see David's city of Jerusalem. You can see Solomon's expansion. But now the Central Valley has been filled in and the walls have been expanded. And this is because of the Assyrian invasion. We haven't talked about it yet, but the land of Jerusalem, here's a Mediterranean Sea, Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea right here. Here's Jerusalem. David is going to unite all 12 tribes. After Solomon becomes king, he drifts away from God, begins to worship foreign gods, which means he's bringing in false philosophies. And a prophet comes and tells him, your land's going to be divided. And then we get the first king up here, Jeroboam, becomes the king of the northern 10 tribes, which is known in your Bible as Israel. We'll spend one night going through the kings of Israel. The southern kingdom of Judah, of the tribe of Judah, which includes now Benjamin, goes with them because they're included in this. This becomes the southern tribe of Judah. So now you've got two kingdoms of Israel, one called Israel, one called Judah. Now, the Assyrians are going to invade, and in 721, the Assyrians are going to destroy the city of Shechem right here, or Samaria right here, and the whole land, and disperse the northern 10 tribes, the lost 10 tribes of Israel, which in a sense has a truth to it. We're not sure where they all went. We know they went into Assyria and Babylon and into Asia Minor, Turkey. They were scattered all over. But they're really not lost in the sense that we don't know where the 10 tribes are at, because just as surely as they were scattered, what would you do if you knew your empire or your kingdom was falling and the Assyrians were coming and they're hauling people off? Well, I don't know what you'd do, but after looking at history, I would run south. And I'd run down here to Hezekiah in Judah, and many of them did. So from Naphtali and Dan and Manasseh and Ephraim, all of them came down south. And so when they came down south, Hezekiah's got this huge influx of people. So by 701, as you can see on this map here, it's like, where do we put all these people? And they're settling outside the city of Jerusalem. And so what he does, he extends the wall, and part of this wall can still be seen today, part of Hezekiah's extension of this wall. You can see it. And they lived in there. And that's when he digs the tunnel called the Hezekiah's Tunnel, recorded in the Scriptures, talks about in the Bible, and makes a pool, as you can see on the map right there, which is called the Pool of Siloam. And that is where Jesus sends the man. He heals the man and sends him. He says, go down to the Pool of Siloam and wash your eyes. And then he walks down from the temple down there and washes his eyes. So you got the Pool of Bethesda at the north, which is the sheep's pool, still in Hezekiah's day. It's still just a pond. And there's a pool of some sort called the Pool of Siloam, but it's going to be rebuilt as time goes on. Okay, that's Hezekiah's there. Are you still with me? You can see on this map, you should be able to identify where David's city that he conquered is at. You should be able to see the Temple Mound and should have an idea of where the city expanded. And now notice Mount Zion is within the city limits. Okay? Turn the page. Within 200 years, we go up to 586. You actually want to go to 605. You got the first Babylonian invasion into Jerusalem or Judah. Then 597, there's another invasion. Daniel's taken captive in the first one. Ezekiel's taken captive in the second one. Then finally, in 586 B.C., 721 in the north, the Assyrians take Israel. Then in 586, the Babylonians take Jerusalem. And, of course, they're 70 years in captivity. How you want to count that, we'll talk about that eventually. But now Nehemiah is going to come back from Babylonian captivity. The city is turned to rubble. They burned the thing down, trashed the temple. The Ark of the Covenant is lost. They haven't seen it since those days. And here we have it right here. So now they come back, and of course the Gihon Springs are still there when they get back. And the Hezekiah's Tunnel is still there. In fact, it's still there today. You can go over there and walk through it. It's about 3 football fields wide or long. Takes you, you know, however fast you can walk 3 football fields, unless there's a crowd of kids up in front of you like we had when we went through there having a pool party. But anyway, it's still all there. But you see, this is how they built it. What they extended a little bit up there was to the north of the temple, or excuse me, to the west of the temple. Not exactly the same as Hezekiah's day, but that became the city of Nehemiah's day. And just kind of, you can see some things right there. Shepherd's pool, different things. Now let's go to the next page. The next thing that takes place now is Jesus' day, 30 A.D. So a lot takes place between 433 and 33 A.D. You got about 400 years there, 460 years. But just a little bit there, you can still see the city of David. The Pool of Siloam now is now very well built, and this is what remains today. Great story about this. Oh, man. If you look in a Bible dictionary, it will show you a picture of the Pool of Siloam, which is really just a waterway. It's just the waterway that comes out of the Hezekiah's Tunnel, and they just thought that was the Pool of Siloam. This must be the Pool of Siloam. They thought it for years. Anytime you get a picture in a Bible dictionary, that's what it's going to show you. The internet may be updated, but it was about 18 months before we got there. They're doing some civic work. They're doing some sewage work, running some pipes and things, just to the west of the Pool of Siloam. And lo and behold, they uncovered an ancient pool from around Herod, that Herod had built during the days of Herod, Jesus' day. It had steps. It was a nice square pool. It was clearly the Pool of Siloam. And they hadn't known it for years that this was here, but again, confirming the book of John and other places that that pool was there. And so now you can see a definite, when we got there, it was still half of it was still covered up with dirt. It was somebody's backyard. And they're going to have to try and negotiate with this guy. We want to buy your backyard because the Pool of Siloam is right here. God, no, I like my grass. You know, it's like, but it was amazing right there as these things are continuing to uncover. But anyway, you can see the Pool of Siloam by this time is well built. Herod's got a palace over in this area here on Mount Zion. And again, notice how far the city wall, the southern city wall, goes south, way down here. I do want you to notice also where the cross is at. This is where the wall in 30 AD was at. And Jesus was taken from Mount Moriah, where Fort Antoniah was, where Pilate would have tried him, and walked basically right around. You can just go from Mount Moriah there and go out one of those gates to the cross area. And that was an entryway into the city. So anybody coming into the city from the west would have walked by this crucifixion site. And it wasn't just designed for Jesus. It was designed for Roman criminals. So when you come into the city of Jerusalem, it's kind of like, whoa. It's kind of like any warning signs. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, the Romans are in control here. And so it was kind of like a warning sign. And right beside there was a garden or a graveyard where they had tombs dug out. Now notice, I want you, this is important, notice where the cross is at. That's today where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is located, exactly there. Now turn the page. Now notice where the cross is at. Same location, except by 70 AD, in the next 40 years, from the time that Jesus was crucified until the Romans totally destroyed the city of Jerusalem, they've expanded the walls going clear up north. You can see in that area there. And so by 70 AD, the site of Jesus' crucifixion is inside the city. You understand what I just said? That's important to understand. And, of course, there's your city of Jerusalem at that time. You can still see the city of David that David conquered way down there. The Gihon Springs is there. Temple Mount is still there. By this time, the Pool of Bethesda it's two different square pools with five colonnaded porticos, which means colonnaded means they're pillars with little roofs on them. And there's five roofs going around those two poles, as John records. Mount Zion is still there, but now that's where Herod's palace is at. And that is the city that was destroyed by the Romans. Again, notice where the city of David is at. Then after all the walls were torn down, Rome began to occupy it. And if you look on the next page, 539, this is around 130 AD. We're outside the Bible now, but we're leading up to where we're at today. Let's find the city of David. It's still down there, but all those walls are pretty much trashed. You see the dotted line? That kind of outlines the city boundaries that they called their city, but really the walls were gone. The Romans occupied it. Pool of Siloam is still there. The Gihon Springs are still there. Pool of Bethesda is still there. Mount Zion is still there. But where, and again, they found all kinds of archaeological evidence of this. Josephus records this, and other historians record this. But the 10th Roman Legion camped there on Mount Zion. And they found all kinds of artifacts and stuff that indicate that's exactly true. But by 130 AD, realize between 70 AD and 130 AD, the Christians, when they saw remember Jesus tells the people in the Gospels, he says, when you see Jerusalem, he gives them two stories. He gives them two scenarios. He gives them the 70 AD scenario. We'll talk about this maybe sometime. Then he gives them the return of the Messiah or the second coming of Christ scenario. In one case, he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by its enemies, remember what he tells them to do? Flee. He says, when you see the enemy surrounding the city of Jerusalem, get out of the city. Because it is a time of desolation that has been talked about from the beginning. And indeed, in 66 AD, when that Jewish war broke out, the Christians, under the leadership of Simon, who would have been Jesus' cousin, who was a relative of the first pastor of Jerusalem, James, Jesus' brother. Okay, I gave you too much information there, didn't I? James was the pastor of Jerusalem church. He got pushed off the Temple Mount in 63 AD, so his cousin Simon becomes the pastor. In 66 AD, when the Roman armies are coming down to stop the Jewish revolt, the Christians, following the scriptures, when Jesus says, when you see the city surrounded, get out. they flee to the eastern side of the Jordan River, going to the area of Decapolis, and spend the next 4 to 5 years there until the Roman destruction of Jerusalem is done. The Jews are all taken and sold into, either killed or sold into slavery. Many of them are taken back to Rome. Guess what the Christians do? They come back to Jerusalem, reestablish a Christian community, and they locate, where, because they remember, where Jesus was crucified, and they build some kind of a monument there, some kind of a memorial, some kind of a worship center, some kind of a church, which they would do at that very location. When the Jews come in 130 AD, they destroy the city again because there's another Jewish uprising. They go up on the Temple Mount, and they build a temple to Jupiter on the Temple Mount. So the Jews will never build there again. They also turn the location of Jesus' death and burial into a temple to Venus and Aphrodite. And the basilica that was there for the church, they turned that into that. And that is, again, the Roman city until 130 AD. Now, the Romans occupy that for a long time. Until three, of course, for a long time, because the Romans are going to continue until, you know, the barbarians invade. But if you look on page 540, before the Muslims come, remember, in 325, Constantine is going to become a Christian. And he's going to now favor the Christians and all kinds of churches. And here you can see all kinds of churches there in Jerusalem during the days of Constantine. All of these churches generally were trashed by the Muslims when the Muslims come after 600 AD, because the Muslims destroyed all of these things. There was one church they did not destroy, and that was the Church of the Nativity down in Bethlehem. You can still see work done in Constantine days on the floor in different parts of it. You can see the place where Jerome translated the Bible there, the Latin Vulgate there in the Church of the Nativity. Because when the Muslims came in, into these churches were destroying the area, taking over, they came into this Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, and on the walls were paintings of the three wise men dressed as Persians or Eastern people or Muslims, as the Muslims' tradition was. And they saw, they go, whoa, if these guys approved of it, who are we? And they bypassed the Church of Nativity, which gives us one of the only churches that remains from the early days, from Constantine's days, that was not trashed by the Muslims because the wise men are painted on the walls. But nonetheless, you can see right here again, Church of the Holy Sepulchre is right there. Go over now to page 541. And now this is the city today. Since in 1535, Suleiman the Great, there's so many stories in all this. Suleiman the Great, he wanted to have a wall built around all the holy sites in this particular area. And the wall that you see today was built in 1535, right during the days of Martin Luther. It was when this wall, if you go to Jerusalem and see the walls, some of the foundation, the bottom layers, I'm trying to think of the word for it. Bedrock. The bedrock, they're building on the same bedrock. So some of these walls follow the same area. But as you go through this, you notice these walls are not necessarily exactly the same walls as the Bible walls. What's missing in these walls? You see the city of David. The city of David is not in the ancient walls from Suleiman the Great. So if you go to the city of Jerusalem today, those are the walls that you will see. But you're going to have to leave the walls of Jerusalem to see the city of David. The Kidron Valley is still there. The Hinnom Valley is still there. The Central Valley is still covered up. The Gihon Springs, there's still water flowing there. In fact, the water still flows through Hezekiah's tunnel. We walk through the water, splash, 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 from the Gihon Springs right down to the Pool of Siloam, the new discovered Pool of Siloam. And then I watch the water run out of the Pool of Siloam across or under a street and down into a gutter. And it's still flowing today. It's a natural source of water. But anyway, there you can see right there. And today it's divided into four quarters. The Christian quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Armenian quarter, which is just a Christian quarter of Armenians, and then the Jewish quarter. And, of course, the Temple Mount is still there, Dome of the Rock sitting on top of that. And that kind of tells you a little bit about the history of the city of Jerusalem. I don't know if you found that interesting or not, but... I really did, and I enjoyed telling you. Are there any questions about that? Anything that you think of that you see that and you wonder, why is this way, or why is that like that? Again, notice the Church of the Holy Sepulchre on page 541. When I went to Jerusalem and I saw this, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I went through it. I wasn't impressed. I thought, just another religious site. Because there's archaeological sites, which I think are very exciting. There's the actual event place that you can actually still see. And then there's these religious sites, which is like, clearly, how do you know this is the site? There's a church. They found the remains of a church that was built in the Crusaders' time, of the place that Mary stopped to rest on her way from Jerusalem to Bethlehem before she gave birth to the Messiah. So there's a whole remains of a church there. Wasn't interested in that location. What is this? But nonetheless, I wasn't interested in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre so much because how do you know? Because when you look at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre today, it's in the middle of the city. There's busyness all around. There's shops. It's in the middle of the city. And you just cannot imagine, because they took Jesus outside into an area of the crucifixion, which was on a road coming into the city, and then there was a garden there. But when you figure out, I actually did some history on it, that is, as we looked at those walls, that is the location most likely. And so right there, it's interesting to see, and there's another whole story about that. But anyway, there we go. Let's go back to wherever we were, page 107. Oh, my goodness. We've covered so far a page. But on page 107, you can see again at the bottom, you see that's the city of David. And from that point, all of that has come from that city of David. It was a Jebusite city, and it was a small city. Okay, turn the page. Oh, hey, there's a picture. On page 108, that is right by on the same side, on the eastern side, near the Gihon Springs. That is a remains of a Jebusite wall looking up from the Kidron Valley. And of course, I'm looking down at it. But you can see that's what's remained of the walls that David would have looked at. And just to the, you can see within there some of the walls built by the kings there to the left. But just to the top where you can hardly see it, and you really it's off the picture, you can see walls built by Nehemiah. And right behind that is David's palace. They've just excavated it. They were working on it when I was there, but they've now come out and identified it for sure. David's palace was right there on this northern side, up there on the northern side of the city. Okay, enough of that. Page 109, you can see a picture of the Temple Mound. Bottom of page 109, you can see the same thing we looked at earlier. Over there on page 108, David did all these things right here as far as advancing Yahweh worship. Remember, he's coming out of the days of the judges. 1 Samuel, with the word of the Lord was rare. Samuel tried to bring some revival to the people, but they still were struggling. He made advances. But then comes 40 years of King Saul, who was a rebellious king who really did things his own way. And Yahweh worship, remember, has no central focus. It used to be Shiloh at the beginning of 1 Samuel. But if we hurry up and get to the book of 1 Samuel, you know what happens during the book of 1 Samuel. The Philistines invade, kill Hophni and Phinehas. Eli hears about it, falls over, breaks his neck outside the tabernacle, and the tabernacle is burnt to the ground. There's a psalm that records this. Jeremiah refers to it as and when they say, the temple of God will never be destroyed, Jeremiah says, what happened in Shiloh? He says, God burnt his tabernacle, he'll burn his temple. And then the Ark of the Covenant is taken over the Philistine territory. So from the days of before Samuel was the judge, through Saul's time until David's early day, there's no central location for Yahweh worship. If you can imagine how dark the days of the judges were when they had the tabernacle, but they'd corrupted it, and then imagine how much darker it would have gotten if that tabernacle was burnt to the ground and the ark was taken away and then kept eventually at someone's farm place. It'd be like taking our culture today with our state of darkness with Christianity and then burning all the churches. And then coming back in 40 years and saying, how's Christianity doing? 40 years ago, we were completely confused. And then they burned all of our churches. What do you think happened? We have no idea what we're doing. And that's kind of where David's people were. And with a classic example, I think we referred to it last week, was when David decides, after he's taken the city of Jerusalem, he decides to go get the Ark of the Covenant and bring it to his city. You remember what he does? He puts it on a cart pulled by oxen to take it into the city. And as it's moving, it hits a rock or something, and the cart rocks, and the ark starts to tip off the cart. And one of the priests does a very noble thing, reaches up and stops the ark from falling, and God kills it. It's like, whoa! And David was like, he was ticked. I mean, just like all of us would be, I do not understand this God. We are doing a good thing for him. And this man was willing to sacrifice and step up and help, and God strikes him down. He says, who can do this for God? And he went back to his city, and a few months later, you continue to read, he comes back with all of the priests and the Levites. They put poles in the bottom of the Ark of the Covenant. If you remember, here's the Ark of the Covenant. Here's a detailed drawing of the Ark of the Covenant. It had rings right here, or they may have been up here. Depends on how you want to talk about it. You got to read it out of Exodus, figure it out. And then they'd run a pole that was covered with gold through there, a long pole, and they'd have a priest carry it. Of course, that'd be his head. Here's the priest's head. There's his shoulder. There's another priest in his shoulder. There'd be four of them, and they'd carry it, just like you see the cherubim moving underneath the sea of glass in Ezekiel chapter 1 when the chariot of God comes in. The priests are in the same positions those cherubim are, in a sense, and they carry the ark just like that. And David came back, had no trouble. Now, what was the difference between the first time and the second time? The first time, David just followed the current culture of the day, which was, well, hey, the ark came from the Philistines on this cart right here with some oxen. Okay, good enough. And they threw the ark on a cart just like the Philistines did. And God says, don't even think about it. Boom, you're not doing it right. Because within the ark and the tabernacle and the temple was the revelation of God that he'd given his people. And if you deviate from the revelation, you go further into darkness. And the reason I'm telling you that is that how dark it was. It was dark in the days of Judges, and then the tabernacle got burnt, and now David becomes king. He says, we're going to reestablish this Yahweh worship. Let's go get the ark. And God says, if you're going to establish Yahweh worship, you're going to do it the way I said. And what did David do during those two or three months? Apparently, he went to the Levites and the priests, got out the old scrolls, says, what is wrong with this God? He said nothing about putting it on a cart. He wants you to carry it on poles with the priest. Oh. And David began to learn, if we're going to work with God, we're going to do it God's way. I think we've all learned that at some level or another. We're going to serve God, we're going to do it God's way. And what David then does on page 108, lists some things that he does to advance Yahweh worship, the worship of one, he conquered Jerusalem, which is interesting because Mount Moriah is there, and this was the very place that God had established earlier on. He brings the ark into Jerusalem. He prepared a tent for the Ark of the Covenant. Now, this is a little kind of a unique time because he did not have a tabernacle, and he didn't have a temple. And the ark appears, this is something you need to kind of study and look at, it appears the ark was just sitting there in Jerusalem in a tent. And people could walk by, you know, take photos with it or something. It's just kind of like, there's the ark. Before, it was always in the most holy place. In the temple, it was always in the most holy place, and no one saw it but the priest once a year. In David's time, it was still kind of almost in that transition period, like in when they took care of the ark in the wilderness, people could see it coming and going. Of course, it was covered up with tarps or, you know, blankets of blue and different colors. Anyway, he builds a tent. He established the priestly line. He went back and with genealogy, established the priesthood. Established the priesthood and divided the Levites into divisions, assigned Levites to appoint singers and musicians. Up until this point, there were no real divisions. They were just Levites. And if you read the book of Judges, the Levites were very confused. Some were just going from place to place working for money. You want me to be a priest there in your local shrine? They'd give them money. They'd just serve all the little gods that they had in the local personal shrine. The Levites were established. Services were conducted before the ark. We can see that in chapter 16, verse 4 and 39 through 42. David made elaborate plans for the temple. Solomon is going to build the temple, but David's going to have collected all of the material, or most of the material, and have designed all the building plans. And Solomon's just going to have to engage those building plans. And then, of course, David purchases the land that the temple will be built on. So these are all things. You see how much David did from the darkness of the days of Judges to a culture that had no tabernacle, had no idea what to do with the ark. David takes it all the way up to a place that they're ready to build the temple. So he did a great job with that. The next page, 110, you can see a picture of the tabernacle or the temple. Now, this is the temple that Herod built. It's a model from 70 AD, a model of the temple in 70 AD. You can see this in Jerusalem. It's a great place to go visit. Then there's a little diagram, more like what Solomon's temple would look like there in that area of that time. Page 111, you can see a map of many of the locations that come up in 1 and 2 Samuel in the early days of the kings. I tried to get everything on there, so as you read, you can find everything on that map. Well, that is our introduction for tonight. And we have to, next week, go through 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, which I was planning on doing tonight. But we'll just, I just want to do like this. We'll just kind of talk about each of these and kind of flip through the pages and tie the story of David together and get us up to the days of Solomon and maybe breeze through Solomon's reign also. Then we can have another night where we talk about the kings of Israel and the next night the kings of Judah and kind of just breeze through them. But I see we're to a place where if we started this, we'd get about, either we're going to start this and be here for another hour or we're going to kind of, we're not going to do that. Or we're just going to have to pause on this. It would be great if you had a couple questions about anything at all or any insights or thing you want to share. Yes, sir. Good question. That would be right around 900 A.D. It's interesting because it's a dome, right? Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock, here we go. Here's the walls, western walls right here. The Dome of the Rock is right here. The actual, where do they worship? Not a synagogue, a mosque. The actual mosque is, it's El something, is right here. This is the mosque. This is not a mosque. It's just an honorable place. They're marking the place where supposedly Ishmael was offered by Isaac. The Dome of the Rock, meaning, okay, are you still with me? You remember I said Mount Moriah is underneath there and the sandbox is built around it? The Dome of the right here, that is the rock. That's still the bedrock of where we would say Isaac was offered. But that is the bedrock right there where the Ark of the Covenant would have stood. In fact, there's photographs you can see that there's a divot in there, a little place that is very close to the size of the Ark of the Covenant, where the Ark of the Covenant may have stood. They built a dome over the top of that rock because that's where Ishmael, they think, was offered by Abraham. Now, the reason it's a dome is because, remember, the crucifixion took place just to the west of over here? The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is two domes like this, two, and they've been built and added onto for years. But in Muslims, right around 600 A.D., the time they began, by 900 A.D. is when they built this Dome of the Rock. Christianity was an influence in Jerusalem, and they are trying to take over. They're trying to take over the holy city. They're trying to drive out the Christians and show up the Christians. And so what they did, these are, you know, nice, and they're impressive little domes. They're not little, they're big buildings. But what the Dome of the Rock is, it actually looks down on these, and it's bigger and golden. So when pilgrims would come, if they be Jewish, if they be just, you know, Arabs, or if they be Christians, they come into the city of Jerusalem, they go, oh, here's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Yeah, but what's this one? And it drew people, and it was to show up the Christians. And I've always wondered this, there was nothing up here? And by 90 AD, this was still, it was a garbage dump. Because the Christians had no honor of the Jews. They didn't want to rebuild this. They had nothing to do with this. They're all in the church age, per se. And they just left this empty because they didn't want to do anything to honor the Jews. And the Muslims just moved in and said, we'll just take over this empty place right here. And they end up, that's how they built that right there. Inside that, around the walls, written in Aramaic, Arabic, it says, cursed are those who believe God is three. Yeah. Yeah, and so right here, here's the Dome of the Rock. And the reason, read what it is, looking right down here. It's all about, this is way before George Bush was president. This was all about pushing the way they built it, tried to upgrade their statement. It is all about putting down and dissolving Christianity and taking over the Jewish Temple Mount. I mean, it's from the beginning, it's a takeover. I mean, no doubt about it. Yes, ma'am. Right, I'll explain it to you. up here, Samaria, Israel, the northern 10 tribes up here, 721, the Assyrians come in and disperse them. And the large groups of Jews then were just dispersed all around the Assyrian Empire. We can still find possibly trace of them. They talk about being in certain mountain ranges where they still have certain Jewish traditions and they all kind of have a certain culture that it looks like maybe this was a pocket of them that got settled here and they've been there for, you know, since 721 B.C. And so those are the lost tribes. We're not sure exactly where they went. Because in Revelation, is it chapter 7, it talks about 144,000, 12,000 from each tribe, and it names the tribes. Because of that, 12,000 from each tribe, including the lost tribes, the idea that these 12,000 are going to be relocated. Well, here they are in the mountains, or here they are over here, wherever. If you're Mormon, you think they were the Native Americans or something like this, or we've now, or because some people think the Aryan race is now. I mean, anybody wants to claim these lost 12 tribes. But nonetheless, that is interesting, and both these are true. They were dispersed. There are pockets of different unique people around that could be the Jews, or the North, and there's the 12,000 are going to be brought back, or 12,000 each tribe. The problem with that is this. Many of them fled down to Jerusalem. I mean, from all the tribes. They fled. I mean, we would flee. I mean, if we were being invaded, people would flee. And the other problem is, when the Babylonians came in and took them captive, they were taken captive to Babylon. And if you go through, you can read the rest of the Bible stories, people from these different tribes continue to be active in the Bible. For example, Esther was from one of the tribes. And so when they were here, they went, and that means many of them came back. So what I'm saying, in Nehemiah's day, there was representatives from all 12 tribes in Jerusalem or in the returning exiles. In Jesus' day, there are representatives of all the 12 tribes still in existence. The problem they would have had, and many of the Levites lost their place, because in the destruction of Jerusalem, in the 70 years of captivity, and by the time they got back, many of them lost their papers. They lost their genealogies. And they just knew they were Jews. And they knew, well, we're related to so-and-so. And so it's like, to be a Levite, to continue in the priesthood, you had to show official documentation. And so many of them were removed from the priesthood because they had no documentation. This documentation was then kept in the temple, in the priestly quarters. And that is why you see in Matthew and Luke Jesus' genealogy. It's like, how? Who would have kept track of that? The Jews. That possibly Matthew and Luke simply went to the priest, or the not Luke, he would be a Gentile, but Matthew or many of them could have got access, just go in there and just copy the information. This is the genealogy leading up to, this is who he was related to all the way through. So the lost 10 tribes is still a truth. We're not sure where they went, those large groups of people. But the fact that we've got to wait for them to be found, really the big problem is the 70 AD destruction by Rome and then the 135 destruction, which really now dispersed them all around the world. And one more thing on this, these 12,000, or the total of 144,000 Jews that will apparently begin to evangelize, they're probably already in place today. Meaning they are already... They're not all going to go back to Jerusalem and then, you know, however you believe eschatology takes place, they go, oh, hey, we better go evangelize the world and then, you know, have a big group meeting and then break and go around the world. They're probably already scattered around the world today. I mean, I don't know for sure. I mean, I know they're scattered, but I would assume this 144,000, they're already in Europe and in America and South America. They're already dispersed around the world. Not that they won't be doing some traveling then too, but nonetheless, yes. Oh, the Jews would leave Nazi Germany to go down to Rome. Is that what you're saying?
In Rome, in the city of Rome, there's an area where there are hollow trees, where these people took refuge in the trunks of these trees that are their refuge. And the Italian people, the Roman people, knew that they were exiled Jews, that they would be killed, so they would leave food out. They would just walk out like they were walking the
country
and leave food there, knowing
that they would find it. Those Jews would have been dispersed then in 70 AD or 135 AD, and those were dispersed more from the Roman dispersion than the Assyrian dispersion, probably. Right. 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 Yeah. During European history, there's been times, especially in like Spain and France, where there'd be pockets of Jews, Christians, and Muslims all living peacefully, simultaneously together, and then different things would break out. Did you have a question or comment? Right. You're talking like 70 AD or Assyrian? 721, okay. We're going to say that again? Right. Right, they no longer had their local, the tribe of Ephraim and the local government. That's true, that's correct. Yeah, a tribe, yeah. Right, he was building it for, because many of the people were fleeing to the city. That's what they would do in those days. Right, definitely, because the Assyrians, if you remember, their next stop was Jerusalem and Hezekiah. That's true, but there was an influx of people from, we know that they were coming. But that's also a true statement, that they were coming into the city. And you remember, Jesus tells them in the final days, he says, when you see this happening, do not go to the city, because he says, get out. And so it's just interesting that what he was saying was, you're used to, just like you're saying, in a time of invasion, of everybody running to the city. He says, in these days, do not do that. The city's coming down. So, exactly, yeah. So what he was saying, well, we did talk about the northern tribes coming down and making Hezekiah's city bigger, but also there's people from Judah also fleeing to that same city. Exactly. And they were building it not just for the protection of the people, but like the water source. Hezekiah's town was to get that water source more centralized so we don't lose that. Because, the way they fought battles then, in Samaria was a 2 to 3 year siege. Babylon had a 2 year siege. They just starved the people out. And so if they could build a wall around their water source and their food source, they could survive longer. In fact, Samaria records that they were selling dove's dung for a certain amount of silver, because the only source of food was when a bird would fly over. Of course, they'd eaten all their baseball gloves and all the leather and everything. Yes, ma'am. That's Jerusalem. That's Jewish territory right now. The West Bank cuts right. You know, if you look going, I don't have a map of that in here. But if you look at that, the West Bank is just slicing right around that area. But that is still. And there's the thing is, like you see in Jerusalem, the Muslim quarters, there's still people living within there. I mean, there's still Jews and Christians and Muslims still living within the city. They've got their own sections and stuff, but there's still some kind of trade going on. I mean, you know, it's there. And then you talk about those walls that they built, the walls that were built around the Palestinians. We saw those walls. But then it'd be like, you know, there'd be like a, in Israel territory, there'd be a Palestinian settlement. You may have heard Obama talk about the settlements usually stop building their settlements, which is part of the peace treaty. But the Palestinians also have built settlements in Jewish territory. And what was happening up until they built those walls, And again, I'm boring you now probably, if I haven't been already. But before those walls were built, the Palestinians could go like, you know, they could be like living across the street, come over here and bomb the store. And then, you know, well, of course, they wouldn't go back home. They got blown up. They just walk across the street and blow something up. And so the Palestinians tended to live together. What the Jews did was just build a wall with a checkpoint. You can live there if you want to, but you can only come out this gate. And it cut, they said when we were there, it cut the suicide bombings down like 90%. Because, you know, you've got to come through here, and we're going to check everybody that comes through here. And to get to work, it's like, well, it's such a hassle. It's kind of like, yeah, it's a hassle. It's a hassle to die, too. So go through our checkpoint. And then the world and the UN, it's like, this isn't fair. You're building walls around the Palestinians. Yeah, because if we take the walls down, they just walk across the street and blow us up. And so it cut down. You know, so until you got this, and again, now I told you that from my perspective. If you want to hear the other side of the story, there's another side. And it's like, I would not want to be Obama and make statements about what you're going to do, because good luck with that. Although, when you look at end times, again, eschatology, something's going to happen. Something, and we may be ready for that. I mean, you know, you can't say for sure. I mean, we're looking, there's going to be, the temple, you know, is going to be rebuilt. And you're looking on that, and the Jews aren't going to build it, you know, in California. You know, they're going to build it on the Temple Mount. And when you look at it today, it's like, my gosh, somebody is going to come and convince somebody of, there's going to be some major wheeling and dealing going on, you know, like the two states, and maybe, I mean, whoever maneuvers through that and gets that temple rebuilt for the Jews, some wild things have got to take place. There's going to have to be a war. There's going to have to be a major peace treaty. There's a variety of ways it can happen, but it's, you know, to stand where we're at today and look at where it's going to go, you know, you want to keep reading the newspaper every morning, because it's something's happening. Yes, sir.
What do you think about the rumor that the Jews have a red heifer, a blemish-free red heifer ready to go?
I don't think that's a rumor. I think that's, when I was there, I'd read about this place called the Temple Institute. You hear about that all the time on internet and books and stuff. So I decided, they didn't show that to us, so I thought, well, I'm going to find it. So one day we had the morning free, so I looked up the Temple Institute, and I was going to go visit the Temple Institute, because they've got all these things ready to go. And, you know, I'm expecting, you know, a store kind of like Jerry's here. You know, it's like you walk in and go, well, here's the glass case of, you know, the priestly garments. And I walked by the thing twice. I walk, you know, we're in these old streets, these old shops, and I walked by it. I thought, well, here, this is the numbers. I walked by it, come back, I thought, well, it should be right here. Look up. Little Temple Institute. What? I mean, Generation Word has got a better logo than that. and I go in there, and it was just a little shop. And then you went through the shop. They had some little trinkets to buy about the temple and stuff. But then you go into the back room, and they had three or four rooms in the back, and they had all of these things. And they gave us a tour. I wasn't on a tour. I just kind of slipped in. I came, and they thought I was with the group in front of me. So I thought, well, I'll just kind of go with them, because they had kind of paid to get in as a group. I thought, well, I'll go in. You know, I went in there, and I sat down. And they started talking to him in German. It was a German tour group. And so I heard I had the whole tour of the Temple Institute in German. It was like, so I didn't learn much. I'm German. That's why I look like everybody. Yeah, I look like all these guys. I just didn't say anything. And so, yeah, we did see it. So I believe, you know, and I didn't see the red heifer or anything like that, but I do believe they're, when they say they're ready to go, they are. One, I don't think it has to exist. I don't think it has to exist. But yet, so many things tend to be coming back together that it would sure be clever of God to have it exist. I don't think Indiana Jones found it, but yeah. But there is a lot of talk, especially guys like Jeremiah, that Jeremiah did hide it. I will tell you, I was going to say this to you too. Here's that sandbox again. There's Mount Moriah underneath there. Now, and here's the temple or the Dome of the Rock, whatever. You understand what I'm talking about right here? The Western Wall. And there's so many things I could tell you about this. But this is all fill. See, this is all fill. This is the bedrock. This is the mountain. But there are all kinds of tunnels underneath here. We could go back in here and we could see the rabbinical tunnels. There was a time, for example, so they got into these rabbinical tunnels, and they came up on the on the north side, some Jews. They went through some tunnels, and they came through. They came out a door up on the streets. This was just like 10 years ago, on the streets on the north side, into the Muslim quarters, and a massacre broke out. Because not only do the Jews think this is the location of the most holy place, that's why they worship at the Western Wall, because that's as close as they can get to that location, but the Muslims also consider this holy. And to have Jews running around in tunnels underneath the Dome of the Rock is not a good thing for Allah. And so they just slaughter them. There's a major... So in other words, what I'm saying there is these tunnels or this fill, you can get down in here and go through all kinds of places. And there could clearly, especially when you understand the genius of the building that has been going from Solomon's people and through Herod's time, is they could easily... have, like some people say, that Jeremiah or some people on supporters of his, when they saw the Babylonians coming, especially Jeremiah was a priest, got kicked out of the temple, of course, for his sermons, but he could have had access, and he may have taken it and hidden or convinced a group of priests that were you know, sympathizers with his message, and they may have preserved the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant talks about, I know the bronze basin talks about the altar, the lampstands, of these things being mentioned in Chronicles of being taken with Nebuchadnezzar. But the Ark, they're just silent. They're just silent about the Ark. I've always taught that the Ark was probably taken by Nebuchadnezzar. And people, well, wouldn't they all die? Well, what was powerful about the Ark of the Covenant was not some kind of the gold or electronic force. It was the presence of God. And in Ezekiel chapter 9 and 10, you see the presence of God leaving the temple. He says, I'm out of here. Next time you see him over in Babylon. So I've always thought the Ark was just a gold box with wood lined with gold. And so when Nebuchadnezzar men tore that through the curtain and grabbed the Ark of the Covenant, they're just grabbing a gold box. They could have took it back and melted it down or something. So I don't know. I think it could possibly be hidden somewhere. Some people says it went to Egypt when Jeremiah and his people, because if you read Jeremiah after they killed Gedaliah, the governor that Nebuchadnezzar put in charge, they killed Gedaliah, then the people went to Egypt and faced... Jeremiah says, don't go to Egypt, because Egypt hadn't fallen yet. They got there just in time for Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Egypt, and they got destroyed again. And so it's like, just listen to the prophet, would you? They didn't listen the first time and suffered in Jerusalem. Then when he says, don't go to Egypt, they says, you're going, and they took Jeremiah with them down to Egypt, and they got destroyed again. Well, some people think the Ark of the Covenant, he may have took it down there, and then down in, I don't know how you say the word, El Fontaine or something like that. There's a city down there with a huge Jewish presence. And there's been some discussion that the Ark is down there too. So that's, I really don't know. It's easy to say it's no longer exists. You don't need to have it. But you can see with all the things going on that it may be hidden and may be coming back. Well, hey, thank you for sitting here so long. I enjoy your presence. And we'll be going through 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel next week. Thank you for coming.